dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man who actually specialized in intelligence during part of his distinguished career in the United States government, specifically the United States Navy, and subsequently has brought a lot of his own intelligence to bear on a variety of very important public policy positions in the government, notably as a counsel in the Reagan and George H.W. Bush White Houses, and then as the Assistant Secretary of State for Narcotics and Law Enforcement Affairs in the State Department under George W. Bush, is our first guest. His name is Robert Charles, no stranger to these microphones. We're very pleased always to have him with us. He's the author of Eagles and Evergreen and a spokesman for a terrific organization, the Association of Mature American Citizens. And you can follow his copious writings there at amac.us. And you also can find him in lots of other media outlets, including this program, we're very pleased to say, with regularity. Robert Charles, welcome back. It's good to have you with us.
Frank, I am just so grateful that you do what you do every week. And I'm always privileged to be with you.
I want to start with what the Biden team is doing every week, it seems. I've written a piece that appeared at Steve Bannon's War Room website and has been the topic of a conversation I had with him earlier in the day. But I'd like to share with our audience sort of the essence of it and get your reaction, Bobby. I'm convinced, really, when you look at the comprehensive and devastating effect that the Biden team is having with its policy decisions and its personnel choices and the various initiatives it's pursuing, really across the board, that it's not so much a presidency as it's a wrecking operation. And the effects are going to be very long-lasting if indeed they can be reversed. Give us your thoughts on whether that's a wild overstatement or maybe an apt way of characterizing a remarkable turn of events. I think it's fair to say this is not something that the American people gave Joe Biden a mandate to do, but is that what's afoot?
You know, Frank, I think you have a way of distilling things sometimes down to a phrase or an understanding. And I think that's a pretty apt phrase. I mean, the problem we have right now, it's hard to know where to begin, is that we, even in the current moment, we're not experiencing probably what will be the nadir or the bottommost point of some of the trajectories that his policies and his team have put us on. So the op tempo, I think, of bad things being loaded into the pipeline is rising. And what do I mean by that? I mean that on the economy, so much poor decision making has now put us in a position where we're going to see out of control inflation. There's just no way. Even the Fed is quietly saying, in effect, they don't see a way of containing it. What we're talking about isn't just even Jimmy Carter style inflation, potentially with this runaway spending, trillions now. I mean, people forget, just go online and look what 1,000 is and how many zeros are behind it. And then what 1 million and 1 billion and 1 trillion. Having worked for 5 years on the Hill, Frank, we never saw $1 trillion bills. That this is a brand new phenomenon, and we've got another one hurtling at us like an asteroid here in the next few weeks. So it's the economy, it's national security, it's a misunderstanding of China, it's an underestimation and a miscasting of Iran, it's a misunderstanding of the intentions of Russia, it's a misunderstanding of why the border is so significant, and the duplicity related to trying to push new restrictions, which essentially shock and cut down the Bill of Rights in the name of COVID. At the same time that you let people over the border who are afflicted with COVID, there's an incoherence. And I guess I'll just summarize it, my own little distillation, this way. You know, to fly a jet by somebody who knows what they're doing is actually not such a difficult task if you ask fighter pilots or even commercial pilots. But you put the wrong person in there who knows nothing, and worse, someone in there who thinks they're in a rowboat, and everything goes bad real fast. And that's the problem we've got here.
It is the case that it seems to me there's a design to it, not just incompetence, which I think most of us would sort of default to under normal circumstances. But as you say, you've enumerated a couple of the examples of real wreckage that is now being left in the wake of the Biden policies, and I'm fearful that we're going to see more of it. A place that most people aren't focused on, but you have of late, Bobby, to your credit, is Latin America. And you've just written a piece about China in Latin America, and I'm very anxious to get your thoughts on this, especially since one of the places that we've seen reporting about what the Chinese are up to is helping the Cubans suppress the popular opposition that has arisen to their various, you know, communist predations. The so-called People's Armed Police. Having spent a lot of time with law enforcement types, I'm sure those folks have come across your radar scope, but they're apparently training up Black Beret in Cuba and I imagine elsewhere for the purposes of repression in the Chinese style. Talk a little bit about that, if you would.
Yeah, so you know, what you've done is you've taken one area, which is absolutely important, and zeroed on it. And ironically, it's hard to know where to begin even in this area, which is the Chinese influence in this hemisphere. I mean, in a way, I want to remind people that, you know, here we are in a sunny summer and, you know, the sun can be shining on you and you feel pretty good and you don't think anything's going to change. But there's an enormous cloud drifting over that sun and it can very rapidly shut out all the light. And I think that's what's happening with China in this hemisphere. I mean, to be honest, the Cuba issue is only one dimension. Obviously, China, interestingly, and as a matter of public record, China, Russia, and Iran supported the Cuban crackdown, the communist crackdown on the freedom fighters who are asking in the streets. They finally have come to the point where their freedom is more important than their lives. And I think we have always stood with people whose lives we treasure because they treasure freedom. And frankly, that's what our founders treasured. Let me just give you a few data points because they're just critical. I mean, China's influence in the last 20 years, that's not a very long period of time, has expanded 18-fold to $314 billion in this hemisphere. They are methodically taking over mines, ports, telecommunications, the electricity grids across the hemisphere outside the United States. Now, they're influencing us here too. They've penetrated research institutions, companies, et cetera. But what they're doing in this hemisphere is overt. They are going down and they are buying up and taking control. And what do they want to do in those locations? They are all tied back to the Chinese military. There's no compunction. There's no question. And they have sidelights. I mean, so another shaft of what I call another cloud that's drifting over us from China is this idea of military police. You mentioned Cuba, and that's true. And they've been tied, for example, also to the UN peacekeeping efforts, but then expanding their tentacles beyond that in Haiti. And in fact, there's very serious concern. Members of Congress have written to the Biden administration because they see things that you and I don't see these days. And they are very concerned that China is seeking to exercise influence not only in Haiti, but on this region to try to get this region to disavow support. And Haiti has supported Taiwan so that they in turn can isolate Taiwan and begin to move out in their own hemisphere. They have effectively taken over. When the United States backed away after the George W. Bush administration, we backed away from support for key allies in this region, including Colombia. And by backing away, we left a gap. As they used to say, it doesn't take long. You pull your fist out of a bucket of water and it fills in behind you real fast. Well, what filled in was China. And so China in this hemisphere, Frank, has gone over and above to try to essentially do everything from security training in places like, you know, Colombia and across the Andean region to trying to push Marxism in Peru, which they apparently are successfully doing. And we're all at risk here. So I think people just need to understand it can seem nice and sunny just now, but the cloud is coming and you need to be aware of the cloud and you need to do everything you can to avert it.
So true, Bobby. And one of the things that we've discussed before is, of course, the emergence of a new, potentially very communist-dominated country in our hemisphere, namely Peru. And I believe there's evidence that the Cubans and the Iranians and the Russians and the Chinese are already, you know, getting their hooks into the new government of Pedro Castillo. It's a very troubled first few days in office for this fellow. I'm told that he's been relying upon and appointing even criminals to his cabinet. And this will have things come out rather badly, rather quickly, I'm afraid. What are your thoughts?
Let me offer a footnote there. I mean, I have personally known two presidents of Peru, gotten to know them in multiple visits during a periods of time when they were seemingly, and neither one of them was Marxist. They were of different stripes and different capacities, but the bottom line was, this president's very different. And I want to just connect some dots for you here so that people see the connectivity. This Marxist President Castillo and the appointment of those that have been tied to the cocaine trade and his avowal that he's going to essentially lift the lid and let massive coca and cocaine syndicates, as they did in Bolivia, take off, essentially
get
restoring
the Drug Enforcement Administration out of the country,
kick the DEA out, et cetera. So that's not only going to destabilize his country and allow rule of law to be replaced by public corruption in a massive drug-funded way, perhaps and almost certainly allowing a resurgence of the Shining Path in certain parts of the country, terrorizing people. But it goes way beyond that. In the Eastern Pacific, we can now expect, and I suspect also up through Colombia, necessarily, just because this is the way they operate, up through the Caribbean, you're going to see a massive wave of cocaine. And one of the things you need to understand, Americans need to understand, is that just this last year, the data just came out 2 weeks ago, we saw somewhere between, I think, 91 and 93,000 overdoses, a 30% increase in the last 12 months. That is unprecedented. We've never seen a 30% increase. And now all those drugs, the fentanyl, the heroin, the cocaine, the other synthetics, they're all coming over the border. They're not made in the United States. And so what happens is you open the door through Peru. And don't think that China and Iran and everybody else doesn't want to destabilize us by feeding the beast. I mean, it was Khrushchev who said that, you know, the drugs ultimately and the indulgence of the American people will ultimately crush them. And this is something we've got to be aware. These are not incidental issues. These go to the very foundation. They're eroding the foundation of the next generation and the foundation of rule of law in the hemisphere, in these countries, but also here in the United States.
So true. And again, another urgent reason for us to be making sure we're not neglecting, ignoring, or otherwise taking for granted what's going on south of our border. You've also addressed yourself, Bobby, to another issue that's very close to home at amac.us, entitled COVID Today, Some Ground Truth. Share some of those ground truths with us, because I think more and more of us are now very confused about where the truth lies on anything having to do with this disease, the disease itself, for one thing, but also the remedies to it.
Well, as you know, Frank, it's especially of concern to AMAC. AMAC represents basically traditional and conservative Americans over the age of 50, and that includes some at-risk populations for the original alpha version of COVID. What do we know? I have spent, just hours going back through not only open source, but going and calling some senior doctors and understanding what they think about this Delta variant. And I'm not a doctor. I'll make that crystal clear from the outset. But what I assess at this point is that we have two threats going on at once, and they're both misunderstood. The first threat is to our Bill of Rights. And I really do mean that. I mean that when you see what's happening in D.C. and New York and other places, thank God for a little bit of pushback from Boston, the notion that we are going to somehow compromise all of our individual liberties now because we have a variant that could be problematic for some subgroups is just utterly unthinkable. And we need to fight back against that. The second big threat is what is this Delta variant? We've gotten cross information from CDC. There's many reasons not to trust Mr. Fauci. He seems to be protecting himself first and the American people second. But let me go to the heart of it. The heart of it is that every mutation, according to doctors that I have now spent a lot of time talking to, every variant or mutation, every virus varies or has mutations, both in its own world and in response to vaccines. It's trying to find ways to survive and to repopulate and to infect. And so what do we know about the Delta variant? By all indications, the Delta variant is a weaker version, which is very, very appropriate. Viruses get weaker as they mutate. The second thing is, though, they also become more desperate. And so they seek to transit or to travel faster. So what you have is a more readily transmissible but relatively less dangerous a virus. So that affects, and undoubtedly it will affect people that haven't had a vaccine probably more, but this is an experimental vaccine. This is not a vaccine. You can't change the laws of physics and biology and time and somehow get a safe ruling on this the way that the FDA usually does if you don't have the passage of 3 or 5 or 7 years. So we're looking at an experimental vaccine out there that seems to be working on 90%+ of the people on the alpha variant and some 8 and 10 on the other variant. Although, you know, to be honest, we don't really know. And we don't know about side effects when it comes to pregnant women or younger children. The variation that I think is most the pinpoint I'll just give you is that I said to this guy, can you give me the latest doctor I talked to, senior, can you give me some understanding in your real life environment about what people are looking at? He said, sure. Last week, I diagnosed 20 people with a Delta variant in an ER. And of that group, 18 were under the age of 18, and one was 3 months old. And so I, on the phone, I gasped. I said, are you kidding? He said, no, it's not as big a deal as you think. They'll all probably be just fine. This is a relatively weak variant. So then I said, so are you saying that it was more or less dangerous? Those obviously weren't folks who had the vaccine. Where do you come out on that? And he said, ultimately, this has to be people go out, look at what information is available. We have incomplete information. It is a fact that we have incomplete information. They need to assess and make a decision based on their own family and on their own lives and on their own physical conditions. So my takeaway from it was there is a tremendous amount of confusion. It's causing distrust because the Biden administration has used this for political purposes, and that undermines trust in everybody.
Bobby, let me ask you a question based on, in part, what you've just said, but also in part on your experience in the United States military, the Navy specifically. A colleague of mine has shared with me that a unit he knows of in the military has 8% vaccinated in the unit population. They're receiving orders, as I understand it, from the commander-in-chief, that everybody has to be vaccinated. And I'm wondering what your thoughts are on the likelihood that in this all-volunteer force, especially one that is being subjected to the kinds of, well, I think, horrifically oppressive indoctrination that has come about through this so-called critical race theory training and you know, the threat of being purged if you're deemed an extremist by a bunch of leftists and so on. But that we'll see the kind of people we want in the United States military, warriors, people who are patriots, people who love this country, people who take their oath of office seriously, essentially driven from the ranks for one or the other of these reasons, not least of which maybe they refuse to be vaccinated for reasons that you've just described or legitimate concerns on their part.
Yeah, so two separate issues. First, on the CRT indoctrination, the sort of elevation of this transgender business and all of that, using the military as a social experiment, I'm very much against that. I think that it will affect recruiting. I think it's already affecting recruiting. I think people are saying, look, I believe in my country. I believe in the Bill of Rights. I believe in the Constitution. I've been, a lot of people have walked a military cemetery. We understand the sacrifice that was handed on to us and want to do our job. That is now being sort of laid against or put against this idea that somehow by joining the military, you're going to be psychologically exposed to the ideas and not just exposed, but compelled to accept ideas that your conscience doesn't allow you to accept. So that's problematic. That's its own issue. And I have written, if people want to go to the AMAC.us site, you will see deep resource materials you can use at school boards. You can use them talking to recruiters. You can use them anywhere you want on CRT. It's really deep. They've got a deep bench on that. On the other issue, vaccines, you know, I'm of two minds, and I'll tell you why, Frank. We want warriors. Warriors, every warrior, everybody who signs up in the military signs a thing called a page two, which is basically, you know, what do you do with my what's left of me when I'm done and I've expired, right? So we know what we're doing, and we all know that. And I have to laugh aloud in a way because people, this is an experimental vaccine, so there's valid reasons for people to say it is not FDA approved. I am not eager to take this because I don't know whether I'm going to end up with a thalidomide child now as a result, et cetera. So there's valid reasons to know why and what. On the other hand, what we see in the immediate evidence is that it has a deterrent effect on the viruses. The viruses carry their own risks. And so there is some, you know, serious validity as you get older in age to have this rather than, you know, the very young. But I will tell you that when I was in the military for 10 years, military has a way of sometimes losing your medical records. I think I got 3 anthrax shots. I got shots for everything because when you were on active duty, you basically just take the shots they give you so you can go do whatever you got to do. And I will just say there is an element of the United States military. There are people in the United States military who are deep patriots who will say, look, I signed up to take risks for my country. I don't like this. but because I don't know what I don't know that they even know what they're administering to me, but I'm going to do this. And I just think the bigger concern to me, Frank, is not a virus and a vaccine that over time will probably find has some side effects, but God willing, are not enormous. I think the bigger concern is the indoctrination of our military cadre, our deepest and best patriots, with some sort of cockamamie CRT stuff that even Martin Luther King and Abraham Lincoln would be dead against.
We can stipulate to that. I think the other, you know, may be a matter of personal judgment, and we'll watch this play out. And Bobby, I know you'll be putting eyes on it, and we look forward to talking with you about what you see and make of it as well. Thank you for your time today, my friend. Come back to us again very soon, if you would, and keep up the great work you do at amac.us, right, as you can. Next up, we're going to speak with Trevor Loudon about the problem of the enemy within, Eric Swalwell being case in point. More straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Radical New York Mayor Bill de Blasio yesterday announced the imposition of a vaccine passport requirement in his city, declaring, quote, "If you want to participate in our society fully, you've got to get vaccinated," unquote. Henceforth, if you want to partake in indoor activities at restaurants, gyms, and events there, you will need to demonstrate you've received a gene therapy approved, so far, only for emergency use. A recent troubling webinar warns that such requirements may not be merely unethical and unconstitutional. They may usher in a digital platform like that the Chinese Communist Party uses to aggregate personal medical and other data. Big tech collects on us to insinuate into this country a counterpart to the CCP's Orwellian social credit system. Visit stopvaxpassports.org to learn more and find out how you can oppose such a mortal threat to our freedoms. This is Frank Gaffney.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We're visiting in this block with one of the most interesting men I know, a man of extraordinary intellect and established understanding of some of the most difficult problems in our country. He comes to it from afar, from New Zealand, but he comes to it with a very clear-eyed perspective on how one can lose a country from having seen it take place in his native land. His name is Trevor Loudon. He is an author, a filmmaker, an essayist, a podcaster, a man of many parts, and a great resource, particularly on a phenomenon. I think he's helped coin the phrase for it, The Enemy Within, which is the title of a major book on the subject and a film as well. He is joining us to talk about the nature of that enemy within, give us an update on a couple of specific manifestations of the phenomenon and what we best be doing about it. And I couldn't be more pleased to have him with us always. Trevor, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio.
Hey, thanks very much, Frank. It's always a pleasure.
Let's start with a topic that is very much on my mind. Trevor, we talked about it with Sam Faddis, one of our colleagues, yesterday, and I think it's weighing on you as well. And that is that when you look at the enemy within, the involvement in fomenting, enabling, and otherwise aiding and abetting those inside the United States who are hostile to our country or seeking to take it down are playing more often than not with the Chinese Communist Party, an enemy without. And I'd like to talk about this in the context of a specific individual, Eric Swalwell, a member of Congress from California, who serves, even to this day, incredibly, on the House Intelligence Committee, despite the fact that he is acknowledged having been intimately involved, and I use that term advisedly, with a Chinese spy by the name of Fang Fang. Walk us through what's going on here, as you see it, and how this fits into a larger sort of paradigm of what we're up against.
Well, you know, Eric Swalwell is the poster boy for everything that's wrong with an American internal security. You know, this is a man who was a city councillor in Dublin, Northern California, a little town, and he decides to run for Congress. And he was aided and abetted by Christine Fang, sometimes known as Fang Fang, who raised funds for him, attended events with him, boosted his career, and helped to get him elected to Congress. She put interns in his office. She had influence on him and other Democrats in the area as well, by the way. And it turns out that she was identified as a Chinese spy. He had an affair with her. He was sleeping with her. So he was intimately involved with a Chinese spy over a period of several months, maybe years. And now he's serving on the House Intelligence Committee. And Nancy Pelosi doesn't think that is grounds to remove him from the House Intelligence Committee. And the Republicans on the House Intelligence Committee don't think they should be making a major fight about this. They think where they should just leave it up to the electorate in California to decide. And as the man is in a very, very Democrat-heavy district, it's most likely that he will be reelected. Because nobody's making an issue of this, so his local constituents probably won't even know much about it. So this is negligence on the Republican side, and I believe this is malfeasance on the other side, because the people around Nancy Pelosi are so intimately involved with the Chinese themselves. So this is a real national security problem, and what should be an open and shut case, the man should be instantly removed from any sensitive position.
Yeah, and the sensitivity of that position is all the greater because, in addition to being just on the House Intelligence Committee, he's actually chairman of the Intelligence Modernization and Readiness Subcommittee. And as I discussed with Sam Faddis, that means essentially access to all of the most sensitive secrets involving our most sensitive of agencies, our intelligence community. Let me ask you this, because Sam Faddis, as you know, is a former undercover intelligence operative himself, ran spies for the Central Intelligence Agency around the world during his career. He says, Trevor, that the likelihood is that the Chinese Communist Party would want very much to continue to have Eric Swalwell as an asset, even after he's been exposed in this way. They would continue to handle him just in a much more discreet fashion. Do you have any insights into that? Does that sound right to you? And if so, doesn't that greatly intensify the concerns that you've just expressed?
Okay, this is exactly right. This is the modus operandi of any intelligence service. You recruit somebody at the beginning of their career, when they're a low-level city council member, before they're even in politics, you help them to get into politics, you guide them into sensitive positions, and then you use them as an asset, either to pass on information or to influence policy or both. So this is a classic recruitment operation. The only thing we don't know for sure, was Swalwell formally recruited or not? Well, the evidence would tend to be, you know, we should err on the side of caution there. Looking at it objectively, you would say, yes, most likely he was recruited. Given his trajectory, given where he is now, and given Nancy Pelosi's reluctance to remove him, you would say that is the most likely what happened. But when it comes to a position like his, when we could be in a shooting war with China at any time, to even have someone like that anywhere near the intelligence apparatus is just absolutely grossly neglectful at best. And so,
Trevor, this is a key point,
it should be highlighted. You know,
yeah, absolutely. I don't know that enough of us are attuned to that possibility, but maybe. Many even in this listening audience, informed as they are on these subjects, would find that unlikely. But the truth of the matter is we've been at war with the Chinese Communist Party for decades, I believe. We haven't noticed it. We haven't responded to it appropriately, but they certainly hard at it. And that could go kinetic, as you say, at any time, whether it's over Taiwan or some other pretext. We'll be talking shortly with Victoria Coates about the possibility that this could arise in connection with China's involvement with Iran at a moment when the Iranians seem now determined to choke off the Strait of Hormuz, having secured a port that would enable them to continue to supply oil to their new Chinese sponsors without using Hormuz. All of this is very, very important stuff. And just before we leave the topic, I did want to ask you about...
There's another point there too, but because, you know, look, intelligence is about trust. And, you know, you think your intelligence officer wanting to testify about important matters before Swalwell's committee. Would you be willing, given what you know about Swalwell's background, to be frank and open? Would you? So there's a dampening effect here, which is going to stop the free flow of intelligence, because the professional intelligence officer knows that he cannot trust Swalwell. So this is going to be a major problem in many ways.
In connection with your observation that Nancy Pelosi may have her own reasons for wanting to keep Swalwell there, among them may be the extent to which she herself has been compromised by the Chinese Communist Party. There's a very important backgrounder that you contributed substantially to, Trevor Loudon, at a website called the Accountability Initiative, accountabilityinitiative.org, about the San Francisco Democratic political machine. And the extent to which not just individuals like Swalwell, for that matter, Dianne Feinstein and Judy Chu, but Speaker Pelosi herself have over the years had ties to those involved with the Chinese Communist Party or organizations, that they sponsor. This is a topic that I think also requires our attention, does it not?
Look, absolutely it does. There are several leading Bay Area Democrats who could not pass even the most basic security background check, Nancy Pelosi being amongst them. So what you have to think is, are they protecting each other? Is there a real nest of these people? Is Swalwell only the tip of the iceberg? I believe that to be the case.
Fascinating stuff, and terribly important at a moment like this, as you say, Trevor Loudon. Let me ask you quickly, just to tease your forthcoming film, which talks about the enemies within the church. Give us a foreshadowing of what your research has found and what people will soon be able to see on the big screen.
Yeah, well, the enemies within the church will be released pretty soon, and it's going to be a documentary about the Marxist infiltration of American Christianity, going right back into the 1920s with the Communist Party USA and the Soviet forces, right up into today's woke movement, you know, the so-called woke movement we're hearing about, which is really cultural Marxism. And what we'll expose is there's a clear line, a very clear line between the Soviet and Chinese and Cuban influence in the churches of the 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, and 60s, right up until the woke movement of today. And the woke movement today is transforming American Christianity. And by down the track, it's transforming American politics as well. So from a religious point of view, it's vital to get this out. And from a political point of view, it's extremely significant as well.
It is indeed. And give us a sense of the timing on this, Trevor. How soon will people be able to see this film? And is there any way that they can contribute to what you're trying to do to bring it to life?
Yeah, we'll have it out in the next few weeks. It's in final post-production now in a very prominent production house. You can go to enemieswithinthechurch.com. And you can see the latest trailer that we just put up online a couple of days ago. And we're still looking for money. The production is fully funded, but we're still looking for money for the distribution budget, because the promotion budget. So, you know, if people go to enemieswithinthechurch.com, they can see trailers, they can make donations, they can see what the project is really all about.
And am I right? I was in a conversation with somebody the other day, and the degree to which tacking the church dividing it against itself, subverting it, has been a prime goal going back to Marx, I believe, certainly to Saul Alinsky and Industrial Association. Is that what it's called? That he
Yeah, the organized? Industrial Areas Foundation.
Areas Foundation, that's it. Yeah. Talk a little bit about that, because it really reinforces powerfully the importance of this new project.
Yeah, well, so, you know, like revolutionaries like Alinsky, see, the Marx was very much about destroying the churches, but more later and more sophisticated revolutionaries realized that it was often better to harness the church towards socialism, because the churches had money, they had respectability, and they had influence. So revolutionaries like Alinsky put a lot of store in infiltrating the churches and turning the churches towards socialism. And they would set up their interfaith dialogue. They'd bring the Jewish synagogues together with the Christian churches, etc., to basically build bridges to bring socialism into the churches. And that is really going on in modern era on steroids. We see it in the Catholic Church. We see it even now in the evangelical churches and the Baptist churches, those very politically conservative churches who elected Ronald Reagan and Donald Trump are now going to the left at an alarming rate of knots. It's a very disturbing phenomenon.
As is this business of interfaith dialogue. It's not that there's anything objectionable about it in principle. It's how it has been practiced and influenced and subverted as well by not just the communists, but Islamists in their red-green axis alliance has contributed mightily to the subversion, as you've been documenting now, Trevor Lawton, of the churches and they're partnering up with, you know, communities of other faiths with the best of intentions, I'm sure, but to their detriment and that of the country. We look forward tremendously to seeing the film, The Enemy Within the Church. Trevor Lawton, thank you for all that you do. I invite people once again to see some of your handiwork at accountabilityinitiative.org and, of course, at Epic Times and some of your masterworks, The Enemy Within, book and movie as well. Come back to us again with updates on all of this, if you would, sir. It's great to have a chance to talk with you, and we appreciate so much what you do.
Frank, thank you.
I'll talk with you soon. Next up, we'll speak with Dr. Victoria Coates about what Iran is up to, as mentioned.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. I couldn't be more pleased to say we are joined by Dr. Victoria Coates. She is, among other things, a distinguished veteran of public service in the United States government, notably as the National Security Advisor to Senator Ted Cruz and as the Deputy National Security Advisor to President Donald J. Trump. She has also spent time at the Department of Energy and the U.S. Agency for Global Media. She is currently, I'm very pleased to say, a senior fellow at the Center for Security Policy and also the head of its new Middle East and North Africa project. And it is very much appreciated that she's bringing this to bear for us at a moment when there are some very important developments, and we're delighted to have a chance to catch up with her. Victoria Coates, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. It's good to have you with us.
Thank you, Frank.
I wanted to start with developments of the past day or two. What we're witnessing in the Persian Gulf seems to be evidence of a new kind of free fire policy by the Iranian regime there. Is that what's going on? Victoria, tell us about attacks on various ships and what led up to what seems to be a new latitude on the part of the Iranians to do just that.
Yes, it's very disturbing. And I think it's really important that you get this information out to your listeners, because we've had such a saturated news cycle over the last 48 hours with Cuomo and Delta and all these things that, of course, are very pressing interest to a lot of Americans. But if you cast your mind back to the summer of 19, after, you know, President Trump enacted the maximum pressure campaign, we saw this kind of escalation out of the Iranian regime with attacks on ships over the summer, culminating on the attack on Abqaiq, the world's largest petroleum refinery in Saudi Arabia. And that was when, you know, President Trump basically said, enough, you know, you guys have gone for enough. And that was when, you know, we moved into the phase of getting him options that wound up being the this elimination of Qasem Soleimani in early January of 20. So, you know, the Iranian regime will push things and escalate until, you know, a strong leader says, no, stop. And after the Soleimani action, we saw a great reduction in these kind of provocations. But what we've seen over the first 6 months of the Biden administration is that same testing creeping. And what happened yesterday, you know, make no mistake about it, and you'll remember this better than I, but the Iranians did this in 1988 when they started mining in the Gulf. And these kinds of sea mines are a very dramatic escalation. And what they're trying to do is point out that they don't care anymore about the Strait of Hormuz, that they now have their petroleum terminal at Jansk, and they can supply their Chinese clients through that, which is south of the Strait. And that is a really dangerous signal for them to send.
Because most of the rest of the oil that is generated by countries friendly to the United States, as opposed to the Iranian regime, of course, have to go through either pipelines heading north and west, or principally through the Strait of Hormuz out of the Persian Gulf. And were they to essentially do the sorts of things that seemingly are now part of their playbook, presumably there would be very serious constraints on shipping. Not least because insurance companies will say, we're not going to cover you if you go into those very dangerous waters now, right?
Absolutely. And I think, you know, we need to reexamine holistically our approach to this. You know, the closure of the Strait has traditionally been considered an existential threat to the United States economy because of energy flows. Now, the fact of the matter is that's not true anymore. With the American energy renaissance, you know, we can... And we've demonstrated before around Abqaiq, for example, we can ramp up domestic production and make up for these shortfalls, and you don't have a catastrophic spike in energy prices. So we have the tools to do this. And I think it should open up a new era of cooperation between us and our Gulf partners, where we're not there as a supplicant, we're there as a partner to them in responsible management of global energy flows. So
what does that look like, Victoria, in this setting?
Well, I would like to, obviously, an extremely friendly and collegial way, challenge our partners, you know, UAE, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, all the great energy producers, Qatar, in the natural gas realm, of course, to say, you know, why are you all coordinating with OPEC, you know, with the Russians and the Venezuelans and the Iranians, for that matter? You know, what can we propose so that those irresponsible actors don't have a veto over the kind of stable, plentiful global energy market we all want?
And operationally, does that mean that we would then guarantee, if they were to behave better in terms of pricing, that their oil can get to market through the straits because we will keep them open against what the Iranians are up to? How does this translate into practical applications?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. And it goes back to what's actually the Carter Doctrine from 1980, which was probably the best thing that President Carter did in the national security realm. And he did it at the tail end of his administration when he had received something of an education in the ways of the world. But, you know,
having
the Carter
brought
Doctrine,
to power the Ayatollah Khomeini.
Yes. But, you know, he acknowledged that you're keeping the flow of energy out of the Gulf was a vital national security interest of the United States. Now, that's actually, as I said, not the case anymore. So, you know, what we could coordinate with our Gulf partners and allies to assist them in ensuring the security and the free passage through the straits is what I'd want to talk about. And we had worked on that in the Trump administration, a project we called the Middle East Strategic Alliance, or MESA, which, you know, has an energy and economic and political aspect to it, but then also a collective security aspect. And, you know, one of the things we could help with is, you know, regional missile defense. So, you know, that would be something to protect against the kind of attacks the Iranians are experimenting with. But there's no reason that can't be, you know, largely the responsibility of the countries that are benefiting from the security. You know, we can be leaders and organizers, but, you know, unlike NATO, the burden should be on the partners that benefit from it to ensure that this happens.
Well, I guess the question that I'm wrestling with, and I'm sure you have too, both in your previous capacity in the White House and now, is this is all well and good, but it is going to take both a considerable naval presence and capability and a deterrent to the Iranians to keep them from intensifying their efforts. I mean, it seems to me the port of Jask is the big, you know, changing, game-changing factor here. And I wonder whether thought should be given to doing something to make that less available to the Iranians if they, in fact, insist on essentially shutting down the Strait of Hormuz to everybody else. I mean, a sort of deterrent play here.
Oh, I think you're absolutely right. And it's certainly no coincidence that 2 weeks ago they sent their first shipment out of Jask. So they announced that they were going to do this. They did it. And then they took this action right around the Strait. So, you know, I think that
and
is...
Was that shipment to China?
We don't know technically, but I would be amazed if it had gone anywhere else. But I think, you know, to your other point, it's one reason why, even though we're focusing on China, the word China comes up in this conversation. I mean, China's going to use Iran as a gas station as much as it can. And, you know, we should be engaged in the region for that reason. I mean, people talk about pivoting away from the Middle East because of China. You can't. Because China's pivoting towards the Middle East.
So they are, indeed.
It demands our attention.
Again, whatever we might decide to do about Jask would ultimately bring us face-to-face with the Chinese, I suspect, and their power projection capabilities are such that that might be of a kinetic kind. Who knows? Let me ask you, another player in all of this, of course, is Israel. And some of these ships, at least as I understand it, have had an Israeli connection and may well have been the reason that they were struck. Is that a correct understanding, Victoria Coates? And what do you think the Israelis are mulling at the moment in terms of their own posture vis-a-vis the Iranian?
Well, Frank, as you know, I got back from Israel last week.
Yes,
paid a flying visit. And unfortunately, I think travel is going to lock down again. So I was really glad to get there and get a sense of where their hits are. And, you know, of course, they're very concerned and they see these provocations and escalations on the part of the Iranians as a direct campaign against them, which the Iranians have said they are. I mean, they're not subtle about it. So I think, you know, now is a moment when we need to be, you know, very closely lashed up with our Israeli partners and, you know, sharing intelligence as robustly as we can. I'm sure you saw, you know, the defense minister, Benny Gantz, came out today with a new potential timeline for Iranian nuclear breakout, which is quite short. I think he said 10 weeks publicly. And that's, you know, that for them to come out and say that, given where we are with the negotiations in Vienna, you know, that is a really strong signal from the Israelis. And
that's assuming, of course, that the clock hasn't already started, which is of very real concern as well. Will we know when the breakout is underway, if it hasn't, you know, already been accomplished, for heaven's sakes? Let me ask you quickly, and we've got short time left, about 5 minutes, but I do want to ask you about the subject of a piece that you had, I believe, just recently in National Review about how to deal with Iran's new president, Ibrahim Raisi, who you describe as a combination thug and cleric, which is a pretty unsavory combination, especially in the Iranian hierarchy. How should we deal with him? And is he now calling the shots in the kinds of ways we've just been discussing?
Well, I think we need to remember the Supreme Leader calls the shots. And Raisi will be inaugurated on Thursday because that's where Khatami wants him. And, you know, I think there's always this temptation to see a perceived leadership change in Iran as an opportunity. This is the opposite. This is Khatami saying, I'm not even going to pay lip service to the useful idiots like, you know, Rouhani and Zarif. You know, we're not even going to pretend to be moderates anymore. And I would really anticipate Raisi being a caretaker for Khamenei's ultimate dynastic goal of getting his son Mutaba into the supreme leader slot. And, you know, what I say in the piece is Raisi's the perfect guy to hold things together. He knows where the money is. He knows where the bodies are buried. and be the transition figure to, you know, entrenching this regime for another generation. And if we just stand by and let it happen, with the Iranian people crying out for our help, you know, we will have only ourselves to blame if we're back in the same place in 15 years.
Or worse. And it'd be interesting to see if he got that power, whether he would in fact relinquish it to this younger Khamenei. But let me ask you, just on the point of what the Biden administration is actually doing at the moment vis-a-vis the Iranian regime, it sounds as though it's more about appeasing and legitimating this guy rather than standing with the people of Iran. Sounds familiar. This is what they did, of course, under Obama. Is that correct characterization?
100%. I mean, what they want is another nuclear deal. They can check the box. They will have redeemed what they consider to be the great heresy of the Trump administration and withdrawing from the deal. And then they can get on to their top priority, which is climate. Everything else goes through climate. Everything's negotiable in the name of climate. And I think that's the goal here. Get through this, check the box. We've done it. And then turn a blind eye to, you know, the massacre of protesters, the, you know, the imprisoning of journalists, the execution of athletes, all the unsavory activities that this
to say nothing of engages in. The threats to their neighbors and our interests there as well. Victoria Coates, this is a very troubling forecast, I'm afraid, and I appreciate very much your describing.
That's my specialty, Frank.
Well, I think it's all of ours, and certainly the purpose of this program is to tell the truth about the challenges that we're facing so that we can hopefully make better decisions about how to respond to them. But I think in particular, I appreciate so much your calling to our attention, this very strategic development of the Port of Jask opening up and the Chinese now getting their supplies outside of having to pass through the Straits of Hormuz and therefore perhaps creating an open season on all of the other ships that that are going through there. Just very quickly, have we seen a slowdown in the number of ships making that transit under these circumstances, Victoria, or would you expect to?
I think what we've seen is a big clog up today. It looks like the Iranian mercenaries released the ship they had boarded, but the other ships are hobbled. They can't move. They don't have their navigation. So we'll watch
and
it.
The, and they may not have their insurance either. Yeah, we will be following this closely, as will you at the Middle East and North Africa program of the Center for Security Policy. Victoria, thank you for taking that job on and for coming back to us very soon, if you would. Thank you for your time today as well. Thanks to the rest of you for joining us today. I hope you'll do so again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
This is Frank Gaffney with a word about a truly great American patriot in urgent need. Rich Higgins served in the U.S. Army and as a key civilian Pentagon official and senior strategist on President Trump's National Security Council. After he left the NSC, Rich continued advising Mr. Trump and others about the threats we are facing from enemies, foreign and domestic. He chronicled his experiences over the past 20 years fighting for America First in a terrific memoir entitled The Memo. Now this courageous freedom fighter is gravely ill due to severe complications caused by the Chinese Communist Party virus. He urgently needs help to defray the enormous costs of successive surgeries and a prospective organ transplant. I urge you to join me in contributing to a GoFundMe campaign named Medical Help for Rich Higgins. That's Medical Help for Rich Higgins at GoFundMe.com. God bless you, and Rich Higgins.